This is Writers on a New England Stage, a partnership between NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Writers on a New England Stage brings acclaimed authors to the Granite State to discuss their lives and recent works. And in this episode, NHPR's Rick Ganley sits down with the legendary frontman of the Jay Giles Band, Peter Wolfe, to discuss Peter's memoir, Waiting on the Moon. Told with gentle humor and often heartrending poignancy, Waiting on the Moon is a revealing glimpse of artists, writers, actors, and musicians as they work, the creative forces that drive them to achievement, the demons they battle, and the patterns of their relationships. This conversation was recorded before a live audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on March 18th, 2025.
Mr. Peter Wolfe, I will tell you this. There is going to be no journalistic integrity or objectivity tonight because I'm a total fanboy. And as soon as I learned that this was even a possibility, I raised both hands and said, that's me. I'm coming to do this. I'm thrilled to have you here.
Well, thrilled to be here, seriously. And I'm thrilled to have you be the moderator.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say. We've talked before in the past
with
other interviews and actually get to meet you about 35 years ago or so down in Boston. It's a thrill to be able to sit on a stage and talk with you. Incredible. The book has been a fantastic read. It was a quick read because I could not put it down. And I even went and got the audiobook because I wanted to listen to you tell the stories and hear them in your voice.
How was it? Because I haven't heard it yet.
You haven't. It's, no. I thought the mix was perfect. It sounded fantastic. Even do some voices a little bit.
Well, I tried to, but I didn't want to go too far. And I also, I have dyslexia. And so reading it was, writing it was one thing. Reading it is a whole other thing.
It was a fantastic sounding audiobook, and it made the stories come to life. And that's what I want to ask you about it. I mean, well, first and foremost, for those of you who are just getting your copies tonight, you're in for a wild ride. This book is not like a typical memoir, and I know you didn't want to do that. These are a collection of almost vignettes and short stories, almost experiences, and you could pick up the book anywhere and open a page and be pulled into that story. And it's almost as if you're an observer in it. Is that fair?
I think so, because I didn't want to write the typical cookie-cutter memoir. You know, I was born in the so-and-so and blah, 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 and my mother this and my father work, and then that guy. And many musicians have been doing it lately, and it's good if there's a musician or a person that you're really, really, really interested in. And so my approach in what you were saying was trying to write some stories and make each chapter like a short story. So those who have the book, you can just start in chapter 14 or chapter 7, and there's a certain timeline that the two ladies that helped me with the book, the Muses, I call them the O'Connor sisters. One's here tonight, Nora O'Connor. But Grace O'Connor helped me, and we try to keep it very tight and sort of more like short stories rather than a full traditional memoir.
Yeah, and it's one of those books I think you can pick up at any time and pick up almost anywhere. And there is a narrative through it, but it is some of those stories are, they're almost cinematic in a way. I mean, let me give you this list here. Marilyn Monroe, Mick Jagger, Van Morrison, Bob Dylan, Aretha Franklin, John Lennon, Muddy Waters, Helen Wolfe, Julia Child, Eleanor Roosevelt, Tennessee Williams, David Lynch. That's about 10% right there of the characters that show up in this book.
See, I just had to say, this was not, I didn't want to make a kiss and tell book, nor did I want to make a book that was just filled with, oh, I met so-and-so and I met blah, 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 blah. But I would be backstage with the band, or we'd be on a bus, or I'd be at a dinner party and have a glass of nice fine wine. And before I know it, someone's telling a story, and I'd be telling a story. And I'd always get the same thing. Pete, you should write a book. Why don't you write a book? And Christopher Hitchens, who is an author that I admired, once said, everybody has a book in them. But it doesn't mean everybody wants to read it. So I kept that in mind, and many years ago, I made a list of, some of the stories, outline of some of the stories. And just by chance, as it turns out, as I was writing this book, I realized by serendipity how I ran into certain people. And it was just by accident. And so, for instance, there's a friend that we became friends, Van Morrison. And Van and I met just, he was going to this club that I was working in, and he walked in. He had just moved to Boston under mysterious circumstances. And he walked up to me and goes, "Hey, you know, I got some gigs. I'm looking for some gigs. I got to find a gig, you know." And I said, "Oh, well, you play?" And he said, "Yeah, yeah." And that's how Van and I met.
And you didn't recognize him at that point. He had been out of them at that point, but hadn't, you know, he wasn't the Van Morrison we know now today. It wasn't Moondance Van Morrison.
No, he had just recorded Brown Eyed Girl.
Okay.
And according to Van, he was taken in the middle of the night out of New York City to escape the Italian mafia, taken to Boston by the Irish mafia, landing in a street, Green Street, Cambridge, where he lived with his wife, two children, mattress on the floor, an Ovation guitar, and nothing else. And so when we met at this moment at this club, he and I walked back to Cambridge, Mass, and we became friends. And I think what also sealed the friendship is I had a telephone. Van didn't. And he didn't need to make it a lot of long-distance phone calls. "Hey, Bertha, you mind if I use a telephone?" And so, but one funny story is I had a late-night show on a radio station called WBCN. And it was the Wolf of Goof of Mama Tufa show, making your knees feed your bladder splatter. If it's in you, it's got to come out, because that's what rock and roll is all about. Welcome to the OJ's, a kid from Alabama, keeping it all here, doing it too, and getting right through. We're going to have some fun until the midnight sun. And so Van and I are talking at this first meeting, and he was saying that he just came to town. And we were chatting, and he said, I listened to, when I was doing the radio show, I'd get these postcards, and they're these Audsley Beardsley postcards, an artist with very refined, and in the back was beautiful handwriting. "Love your show. Can you play some John Lee Hooker, Sonny Boy Williamson, and Van Morrison?" And these would come about, once, sometimes twice a week. And once I got one of all these scribbles, "Play John Lee Hooker, blah, 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 Mongo Bongo," it said, was it signed. And I'm talking with Van, he's telling me about these shows. He says, "Hey, you ever listen to the Wolf of Goofa? You know, late at night, play some good stuff." And I go, "I am the Wolf of Goofa." "Cause they ain't the Wolf of Goofa. Wolf of Goofa's a big black guy." And they're... I said, "No, I'm the Wolf of Goofa." And he goes, "No, you ain't the Wolf of Goofa." So I do the rap, "Oh, Wolf of Goofa, Mama Too," and that really sealed our friendship. That and the telephone, I might say.
Radio brings people together, man. What can I tell you?
There you go.
Yeah. When you're writing these, when you sat down, I know you thought about it for years, and people told you you should write, and you started to write. Was the process pretty easy once you started? I mean, I'm trying to think of, you write so in almost a cinematographic way. I can almost picture, you talk about what people are wearing, you talk about the weather, you talk about how the air felt. I mean, it's very detailed. How did you recall all of that?
Well, I started the book, I thought about the book about a decade before I actually started writing it. And once I, in my head, it was all there. And I just couldn't really get it going. And so one of the ladies I dedicated the book to, Nora, who's here tonight, she said, "Look, you tell these stories all the time. Tell me the story, and I'll record it. And then I'll type it out. And then you can look at it, put it on the computer, and play with it." So she sat down with the tape recorder, and I say, like, "Van, well, I was in this club, and I can't tell a story." She said, "But you've told the story. I heard you tell it. I just could," and I couldn't do it, and it took forever. But finally, I would get it on some kind of paper, and slowly I would type. But being dyslexic and never taking typing, I type with one finger. So it's like this. And that's how I did the entire book. But this finger, index, is this the index finger? Is the fastest index finger, I can tell you. There ain't nobody can do an index like this. I can go, doom, doom. So I started typing it slowly together. And then, you know, Nora and her sister Grace sort of would read it and sort of say, well, maybe you're off here. Maybe you can tighten it up a little bit here. And they acted because, you know, you read in these prologues, even by, you know, great authors like Scott Fitzgerald or so, thanks to Max Perkins, who helped make this book possible or helped refine. And I always said, I want a Max Perkins. I want an editor. And so I called up some people that were editors, and that wasn't really what I was looking for. And I found out that Grace O'Connor, who was a friend, a fantastic painter, and we talk about movies and books, lots of books all the time, and she was an enormous reader. She ended up really becoming my prime muse and editor. And with her and her sister, helped me really shape the book. They helped, I saw a photograph, I'm not comparing this at all, but there was a photograph of William Faulkner in his study working on As I Lay Dying. And on the back wall, he had all these cards of the characters and how the cards were going to, you know, how the characters were going to develop in the novel. I thought that was a real interesting idea. So I would have a card, Van, or, you know, Bob, or, you know, Julia Childs, and blah, blah, blah. And I put these little stories and vignettes up on the wall, and slowly, between myself, Grace, and Nora, we started playing around, and that's the book from one to whatever chapters there are.
It's going to be incredible to see that. I imagine that what that wall would look like. It's storyboarding a life, really. A lot of this comes from living in Cambridge for all these decades and being at a certain place and time. Obviously, Cambridge, a really fertile time in the mid-60s in particular for the juxtaposition of folk and rock and, of course, academia. Can you talk a little bit about why you stayed in Cambridge all of these years and what Cambridge has meant to you in your life?
Well, I was living in New York, and I came to Boston to, I was accepted to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts, because all my life I was, you know, really, you know, determined to become a painter. And I studied it as a kid, and I drew all over, you know, I just drew all my life. And once I got to Boston, I lived in a place called the Valley of the Dead. It was, you know, one of those old neighborhoods with nothing but junk cars and tires. And if it was the brightest day, there was nothing but gray. You know, somehow gray just hit this neighborhood. It was just, and somehow, I forget exactly how, somebody, a fellow that was going to join the Allman Brothers Band as a harmonica player, Tommy Doucette, who worked in a sandal shop in Cambridge, said, I'm moving out, you want to take over my apartment? And it cost something like $30-something dollars a month, and right in Harvard Square. I said, well, man, that sounds great. And I moved in, and it was this building that had all these painters and musicians and artists, and it was really quite almost like the Left Bank in Paris. And Harvard Square at that time had all sorts of cafes. So once I was there and stayed in my art school, one night, there was a loft party, and there were these gentlemen, not unlike the gentleman that played a little while ago, and one of the guys forgot the words to a song, and I knew the words. There's a man down there, might be your man, I don't know. And so I knew the words to, there's a man down there, might be your man, I don't know. And I got up, because I had a little cucamonga wine, and I said, and I started singing, let me tell you, baby, blah, blah. And that became my first experience in singing and performing, and I got hooked. And the band, we joined a band called The Hallucinations. I remember it was the 60s, and we thought that was really pretty, you know, zowie. And once I got involved with a band, I was hooked, and Cambridge just became bass, and I fell in love with Boston. And there was a pace about it. You know, there was something other than New York, which was great. But Boston always seemed a healthier place for me. So it always stayed home.
Yeah, you never, I mean, so many of your contemporaries went to Woodstock or L.A. You stayed in Boston?
I stayed in Boston. I think Boston had a great music, really rich music scene, but it never really got on the map because there was no studios, real major studios in Boston or record companies in Boston. So people who got signed, you know, like in Ireland, people had to go to London. And so to get signed or to get anywhere, you had to, if you were in Boston, you had to move to New York. Until there was this dreaded thing that somebody, San Francisco had the Haight-Ashbury scene. And so they tried to create this thing called the Bosstown sound. And it was just this made up fabrication to sort of sell, you know, records. And there was no Bosstown sound. But unfortunately, bands that got caught up in that Bosstown sound never really made it because it became the kiss of death.
Yeah.
If you played New York and you said, where are you from? Boston. Oh, you must be the Bosstown sound, you know. And I think the Giles Band was the first band to break that stigma. Mm-hmm. So we were the first band to get out of Boston and actually make it nationally. And then came, obviously, Aerosmith and the Cars and, you know, Boston, right, et cetera.
You're listening to a conversation between NHPR's Rick Ganley and Peter Wolf. Coming up, Peter talks about his time in the Jay Giles Band and his marriage to actress Faye Dunaway. We'll be right back in a moment with more Writers on a New England Stage from New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back to Writers on a New England Stage. This conversation between Peter Wolf and Rick Ganley was recorded on March 18th, 2025, in front of a live audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
I know originally you were a little reluctant to write about your time in the Giles Band, as well as your marriage to Faye Dunaway. Eventually you did write about both, and very eloquently and beautifully in the book. What was that process like? Was it tough?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because when I started the book, there were two things I decided I was not going to write about. One was my marriage to Faye Dunaway, and the other was the Jay Giles Band. I just thought, you know, this memoir, was this going to be a collection of stories I was told at these parties or on the bus and blah, 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 blah. And was this going to be a collection of short stories? And once I got signed to Little Brown, and I had this great agent, Andrew Wiley, who's the agent for Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis and a lot of great authors. I don't know why he chose me, but there I am. And so he said, you know, Pete, a lot of people are asking about, you know, your marriage and the Giles Band. It's pretty weird you're not writing about them. And I said, well, that's kind of the way I'm thinking about it. And then once I got signed to Little Brown, which was the label I wanted to be, because there's a writer by the name of Peter Gurlnick, who writes some of the best books on music. He wrote these great books on Elvis that anyone interested in it, they're just, you know, the greatest tomes on Elvis, best researched, best written. And he wrote books, Lost Highway, Feel Like Going Home, these vignettes on the musicians that I love. There was another great writer, Nick Tosh, who wrote some really interesting books. And Keith Richards' book was on Little Brown. And it was a distinguished Boston publishing company. And so it was a dream of mine to be on Little Brown. And of course, once I got there, everybody who I wanted to work with all got fired. My life story. So, but before they got fired, they all said, you know, where's the Jay Giles Band? Where's your marriage to Faye? I said, no, this is going to be just short stories. And it just kept coming back and coming back. And Grace, who was one of my muses, we were had dinner one night, and I was telling the story about being on the set of Chinatown. And she said, you got to tell that story. What are you, crazy? I mean, I just read a book about Chinatown. It wasn't half as interesting as that. And so I said, well, I'll just try it out. And one chapter led to another chapter, and led to another chapter, and so be it. So Faye and the Giles Band are in the book.
Yeah, they absolutely are. Yeah. And I won't spoil it for anyone, but there's a story about Jack Nicholson in there that is heavy. There's also, yeah, there's but just, you were, through your marriage, through your relationship with Faye Dunaway, you were able to kind of have a bird's eye view of the upper strata of Hollywood for a few years.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, it was at a time where all movie actors and stars wanted to be rockers, and all rockers wanted to be movie stars. And I think our marriage was one of the first where a rocker and a, you know, movie star got together. And I think shortly after that, Greg Allman and Cher got together. And I remember being at a dinner, and there was Cher sitting, and Greg was kind of like, I thought, that's pretty cool, Greg. But so it was that sort of...
I don't get to go to dinners like that.
No, but it was that sort of period. And I did get to, you know, visit a lot of movie sets and different actors and actresses. But Faye loved being out on the road because she was so involved in having to learn lines and learning where the lighting was and stuff, but being a rock and roller and just, you know, doing things like the Must Have Got Lost rap, you know, that she just couldn't believe was being made up on the spot, you know, different things I was doing. How do you do that? Do you study? Do you have somebody write that stuff for you? Right. What are you kidding? It's stage raps, man. You know, it's like, so it was a merging of two worlds, and we had a really, a very close, great relationship, you know, in the 5 or so years we were together. There was a lot we, you know, had right from the beginning. We never even had to speak about it. Our careers became first. So if she was off in Spain, I'd try to get over and be with her. If I was playing in Oshkosh, Wisconsin at a little joint, she'd come out and join the band and hang out and, you know, ride around with us. And so we, you know, we were just both into each other and our art, you know, keeping the art going for each other. So that's really was the basis and nucleus. I will say one thing in the book, our first date, I was staying at this funky hotel, and Faye called me and she invited me to New York, and I came, and the band would stay at this place called the City Squire. And it was a hotel, to put it politely, was for traveling salesmen. And their friends were all in the lobby, all these ladies that, and so Faye called and said, Pete, where are you staying? You know, I'd love to come by. You know, I said, well, no, I'll meet you somewhere. She goes, no, you know, this was our, we never really had a date before. She goes, no, I'll come over and meet you at the hotel. I said, oh, no, I'll meet you somewhere. And she said, no, tell me where you're staying. I love hotels. And I figured, well, you know, I don't have a pocket, and you know, she obviously knows that. So I told her, she came to the hotel, and I had the TV on, and Gunsmoke was on without the sound. And she looked at it and she said, I love Gunsmoke. And can we watch it? I said, yeah. And she said, and lo and behold, she ordered I never ordered room service in my life. She said, can I order a club sandwich? I said, yeah. So she picked up the phone, ordered club, you know, sandwich. It happened to be a Gunsmoke marathon. That was our first date.
Lucky for you.
Yeah, but not unlucky for me, because I had to pay for the room service. I didn't have the money.
Yeah, one sandwich for two people, right? We've gotten some audience questions. I want to kind of work these in. You talk about stage patter. Somebody wants to know, who actually is Reputa the Buddha?
Reputa the Buddha. Oh, mercy.
The lad of your love.
But me?
The lad of your love.
Oh, well, if you listen closely to the live album of Blow Your Face Out, where I'm making up this rap, and a lot of times these raps came because, you know, now bands have tuners on their guitars or on their pedals, and you know, they just go and they can just tune their guitars up in a second. But in the days of where Reputa came in, you know, you'd have to tune up, you know, bam, bam, you know, the piano player would give the key and the guitar player would get, you know, bam, bam, you have to tune. So while the band was tuning, my job was to entertain and give up a rap. So on before we got to Musta Got Lost, I started talking about this gal, and then you can hear me asking the drummer, you know, what's the name of that gal with the long hair? And he yells out, you know, Rapunzel, 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 Rapunzel. And it all just started coming, and I was just making it up on the spot.
Yeah, so, just mother necessity, you just have to do it.
Yeah, but the crazy thing was once the record became popular, there I was in the hotel room having to memorize the thing. And because people would scream out, Rapunzel, 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 and I don't know what the hell they were talking about, you know.
You've written and recorded with so many artists. Mick Jagger, Aretha Franklin, Muddy Waters.
Ah, Bourbon. Thank you.
I got excited for a minute. I wanted to ask you about the Merle Haggard story. You chased Merle Haggard down to do a duet, which to me is one of the most beautiful songs, Too Late for Me. Just an incredible song. And you spent a couple of years trying to pin him down on it, didn't you?
Well, I don't know as many years, but it was a long time. And I wrote this song with a gentleman by the name of Will Jennings. It was a song called It's Too Late for Me. And in the book, how that title comes out to be is a pretty wild story in itself. Yeah. Will wrote songs like Higher Love with Stevie Winwood, Tears from Heaven with Eric Clapton. He wrote several Academy Award songs, you know, Wind Beneath Our Wings, and the song from the Titanic that everybody loves to hate. What's the name of that?
The Celine Dion song?
My Heart Will Go On.
I think she pronounces it My Heart Will Go On. She's Canadian.
Right. Yeah. And many, many great songs for B.B. King, and just an incredible, incredible songwriter from that great era, sort of not unlike Johnny Mercer. He was a real pro, and he worked with Henry Mancini and wrote for many, many, many people, Sissy Houston, tons, Aretha, a whole bunch of people. And so Will and I had this song, and I said, this would be perfect for Merle Haggard. And Will, who was from Texas, said, good luck, buddy. And Merle was one of my favorite writers, singers, country artists. And if you're not familiar with Merle Haggard, a lot of people aren't, you can just dive in anywhere, because he's just so rich. And he was one of the great, great songwriters. People just know him from Okie from Muskogee, which is a song he wrote really in 15 minutes as a kind of joke. But it came out during the period in the height of the Vietnam War. And he got sort of caught up in that whole aspect. But not really, because he told me, you know, Peter, I wrote that song. I was so tired, stone on grass when we wrote it. We just thought it was a funny, funny song. And Okie from Muskogee. And so this whole part of the chapter is me trying to track Merle down from city to city, bus to bus, to try to get him to do a duet with me, which fortunately I was able to accomplish. But the story is how we all sort of the adventure of chasing down Merle Haggard.
Well, the result was worth it.
Pardon me?
The result was definitely worth it.
Oh,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Just
thank
such
you.
A beautiful song. You know, there's a good question here that I think relates to it. What advice would you give young musicians?
Oh boy. No, why I say oh boy is because, you know, the landscape has changed so much. When I started, you know, you can get together and maybe, you know, create a song, and there was always that hope that, you know, that one song could maybe happen, and your career could be there. And there were so many clubs to work in and just, you know, gather your, like in Boston, we would play like almost every day. There was between clubs, fraternities, you know, fraternities always hired bands on the weekend. And so there were so many outlets for young musicians to work and perform. And you can actually pay your rent being a musician. Today, with the internet, there's an enormous amount of opportunity, but that ocean is so big, and it's so easy to get lost, and it's just changed where things seem to be, and even music itself seems to be so transitory, and I think that's the difference. We mentioned Van Morrison. You know, Van Morrison would release an album, Moondance, and you'd sit with it and read the album and look at it and just really envelop the whole thing like it was a novel. You know, albums were like novels. They was something you absorb. And today, music, I don't think has that. There's great aspects of being able to go on YouTube, and if I mention Jackie Wilson singing Danny Boy, and I advise everyone just go home later and type in Danny Boy, Jackie Wilson, and you will hear Danny Boy like you never heard before. And it's just amazing. So there's a lot of positives, but it's just very, very different. So my advice to young musicians is just, you know, stay with it and follow the dream. Hopefully you have one, and just keep with it. That's like anything else.
I think it's like anything else. If the drive is there, and it's true.
If it's in you, it's got to come out, because that's what rock and roll is all about. True.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. You've had a long solo career, longer than you had with Giles. I mean, does it bother you a little bit that people kind of focus on that? That's 1970s era and your work with Giles?
No, because, you know, I understand it. What does bother me is I put so much work and energy into these solo records that I produced that really have gotten pretty much, are pretty much unknown. So they sort of like cult records, and many of them are out of print. And, you know, there's things that I really value, and I think personally is some of my finest work. And thank you.
Yeah, agreed.
And getting, you know, I'm somebody that really does not like to work alone. I think that's the thing. When I was a painter, when I joined a band, it was the collaborative nature of being with, you know, other people. And so I love collaboration. And that's why when I write songs, I love collaboration. And also working with great musicians that you can choose, which was different than the Giles band, because when you're a group, it's self-contained. But being able to, you know, do a duet with Mick Jagger or Aretha Franklin or Shelby Lynn or Merle Haggard, you know, or Steve Earle. And I mean, these are things that, you know, Nico Case, that you get the experience in working with great players, Bobby Womack and Don Covey. And so the solo stuff really means spiritually a lot to me. But I definitely understand the nostalgia about the 70s and the Giles band, because of MTV and we were able to survive through a lot of different transitions. I think that, you know, there's a music a lot of people grew up on, and I grew up on doo-wop music. So when I had dip, 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 doom, 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 I mean, I just go crazy. And when I hear Elvis, I go crazy, a lot of the records. So I definitely understand it. And I spent 17 and a half years of my life dedicated to being the businessman, the front man, the writer, the singer of the Jay Giles band. So I love the Jay Giles band. And
and you were the primary businessman in the band. You worked with the labels, you know, worked with all the management. I mean, did that cause tension in the band? Was that a problem?
Well, I kind of, you know, there's one chapter on the Giles band, and I think that, you know, for me, includes it all. And so in answer to your question, I'd just say I'd focus on that chapter because it has the beginning, middle, and the unfortunate end.
Thanks for joining us today for a conversation between Peter Wolf and Rick Ganley. Coming up, we'll hear about the impact Tennessee Williams' work had on Peter and the experience of finally meeting Williams. We'll be right back. You're listening to Writers on a New England Stage from NHPR. Welcome back, and thank you again for listening to Writers on a New England Stage. We're hearing today from NHPR's Rick Ganley and Peter Wolf. Just ahead, Peter talks about which musicians were his favorite to work with. This conversation was recorded in front of a live audience in March 2025.
There is a kindness in your writing, even to people who weren't very kind to you sometimes. I mean, was that a deliberate feeling on your part that you're going to treat people with a certain kindness and a softness, or was there... Does that come from age and time? What is that from?
I don't remember me trying to be kind, you know.
It's a feeling I got.
Well, thank you. I mean, I didn't want it to be a kiss and tell book, you know, and I didn't want it to be at anyone's expense, but I did want to, you know, be entertaining and, you know, provocative where it needed to be. But... the people that I wrote about were most of the people that I really admired. And I just couldn't believe that I got to know. And just, you know, for instance, here I am sitting next to Tennessee Williams at the 25th anniversary of Streetcar Named Desire. He's sitting right next to me. And when I was a kid, I saw Streetcar Named Desire as a movie. And I just fell head over heels for the play, and of course Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh, great Kugla Mugla. I mean, she was. I still love Vivian Leigh, man. That's it. That's the top of the mountain for me. And but you know, I was a little punk kid. I'd walk around with a wife beater T-shirt, what they called in those days, you know, the Marlon Brando T-shirt. And you know, I would imitate Stanley Kowalski, and I went out and bought borrowed every Tennessee Williams play, and you know, Night of the Iguana, I'm, you know, like 14 years old. I don't know what the hell he was writing about, but I just became obsessed with Tennessee Williams. Now here I am, it's the 25th anniversary of Streetcar. I'm sitting next to Tennessee Williams, and there's the card scene where they're telling jokes and Stanley's playing with Mitch and everything. And Tennessee starts, you know, he had quite a few before the play, started, quite a few, I might say, or a lot, you know. So, man, he was, you know, he starts laughing in the middle of the play, and these people around him go, shh, you know, shh. And he's hilarious, he's laughing.
They have finally, no idea who he is.
Finally, two ushers come over and say, excuse me, sir, but if you're not quiet, we're gonna have to escort you out. Didn't stop him. He kept on laughing.
These incredible stories, like, and the book is full of stories like that. Just this amazing encounters.
But Tennessee, you know, was a man that some people you meet, but he was like I say in the book, he was like a great, you know, Cartier wristwatch that just all the parts, his brain moved all the time. He was so funny. And his insight, you know, walking around the street with him was just incredible, the things that he said and just his vision of things. And then the sadness of his career as it, you know, as he had a write in a op-ed in the New York Times, you know, people say I'm a writer, but just a ghost of a writer, you know, that I don't even exist anymore, and to just see the arc or be with someone who is so great having to go through that, be humiliated by critics, was just heartbreaking for me.
That is heartbreaking to think about. And somebody who still has all their wit and all their faculties, and people,
I mean,
are writing
every
about
day. He spent all night, I don't know how he did it, but every day at 6 o'clock he would sit by his desk and write. And he would party, not party, but he would, you know, stay up always with people. He always had to be surrounded by people. And, but every morning he would sit and write for 3, 4 hours, 5 hours.
How were you able to avoid that kind of, you know, you came up in an era and you were a rock star in an era of big excess in Hollywood and music. How did you keep your head about it? Was there someone or something in particular that kind of got you through that? A lot of stars didn't.
Well, I think the thing for me was I never really took to grass, because the first time I had to grass, you know, really some real good Cucamonga stuff. I found staring at a wall for about 5 hours. Wasn't that interesting? So grass, and then being so hyper that I am, cocaine was like having like 17 cups of bad coffee. So I never really took to that either. Drinking was another thing, you know, a cocktail or something. But so I think avoiding a lot of the substances throughout my days of, you know, rocking and rolling truly helped me survive a lot of stuff. I mean, you'd get to a hotel and some days, and the first thing people would take off the mirror off the wall, put it on the coffee table, and out came mounds of cocaine, and, you know, and that went on all day and all night. And it was something that just didn't appeal to me. So I was able to kind of address other things. And plus, being active on stage, you know, also had to keep me in shape. So I just somehow, I don't know, kept through it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the results speak for themselves. I think you were, you know, one of the very great front men. And a lot of great front men, you could see, couldn't quite handle that for too long. And
well,
you did, one of the great front men. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no doubt. Looking back, if you could relive any one of these stories, which one would you pick?
Sleeping with Marilyn Monroe.
Enough said, we'll leave it at that. A couple of quick audience questions for you.
Please.
Who are some of your favorite studio musicians that you played with?
Oh, man, that, you know, that's... first of all, Kenny White, who produces the solo records for me, is just... we got together, I was searching for somebody to work with, and Kenny had done these incredible jingles that you all probably know, American Airlines, you know, McDonald's and all that stuff, and he was a, you know, prodigy, musical prodigy. And I came in with this song on this little cassette, and the song was, dun, 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 you know, Waiting on the Moon. And Kenny heard it and said, you know, I like that. Went to the piano and started playing this arrangement. And he looked at me, I looked at him, and we knew there was a collaboration. And we made 5, 6, 7 records together. And so Kenny is definitely one musician. But, you know, again, getting to work with people like Cornell Dupree, who played on all the great Sam Cooke and Aretha Franklin records, different guitar players, some of the band from the Letterman band, Keith Richards, of course, you know, having him play on some stuff, Bobby Womack, I mean, so many people, you know, Elliot Easton from the Cars. I know I'm going to, you know, feel embarrassed that I left people out, but there's Sean Pelton, one of the great drummers, on the Saturday Night Live drumming. And you work with these guys and you come in with a song and you think, you know, you got it on a demo, and you kind of sit around a room and they start kicking it around. And that's what's so exciting for me. All of a sudden the songs, you know, hey, let's try this, man. Or, you know, Duke Levine, who's a great, great guitar player, who's one of my close brothers. We talk all the time on the telephone. He's out now out on the road with Bonnie Raitt. And Duke is a master. You know, he's just a master. And I'll sit down with Duke and, you know, I'll say, Duke, give me a little like a bum, 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 kind of. And all of a sudden, dun, 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 this thing that comes out, and it's just amazing.
They're translating what's in your head.
Yeah, and plus they do it in a way that, you know, it's just working with these great artists. They bring it and they just lift it in a way that you just, you know, just for me, I find so exciting. I love collaboration. When you're collaborating with people that just really are generous, that are into it, and that give you everything they got, man, you can't walk away from that.
Yeah, what does that give you over writing? When you write something, either alone or maybe you're long distance collaborating, what does it give you when you get in the room with somebody and start really fleshing it out? I mean, it's got to be an incredible feeling to feel it just shape and come to form.
Well, like working with Will Jennings, we'd sit up all night, and Will was great. You know, he would turn me on to so many different books and poems, and he had a wine cellar, and we'd go to his wine cellar and we'd just drink wine all night, but 3 o'clock in the afternoon, boom, clipboard in his lap, clipboard in my lap. He'd sit down and we'd, you know, talk about what we might write. We might have a title or something. And if I'd come up with an idea, Will's response would be, that meant, that ain't gonna work. There was a lot of, in the collaboration with Will and I, but, so it was just that kind of process. But before I forget, I feel I always have to tell, there's one or two stories, I always forget what the other one is, but there's one story I just have to tell because I enjoy telling it, and I've told it at shows and stuff. But there's a chapter on one of my favorite musicians, John Lee Hooker. And John Lee and I became very close friends, as he did with Van Morrison. John Lee was one of those people that once you got to know him was to love him. And he was somebody that, you know, he was the quintessential bluesman because he traveled alone most of the time, just him and his guitar. And first date we ever did with the Hallucinations was opening up for John Lee Hooker. And in the book, I describe how that happened. And at one of the dates, I, you know, admired him so much, I asked him if I could come and spend an afternoon with him at his hotel. And John Lee said, yeah, come by Lenox Hotel, 4 o'clock, room 302. Well, 4 o'clock, room 302, I was right outside that door and I knocked on the door and I heard, come on in. Door open, so I opened the door and there's this hotel room, it's all dark. There's two beds and lying on the first bed is John Lee Hooker. He has his Argyle socks on, you know, t-shirt, you know, one of those white beaded, what do you call those t-shirts? I know, but there's got to be another name. I mean, that's not PC anymore.
It's 2025, sir, I think.
Tank top, thank you very much. He's wearing a white tank top. He had a do-rag on his head. You know, on the coffee table, there was a bottle of Ballantine scotch, an ashtray filled with cool cigarettes, a pack of cool cigarettes, and he was stretched out with his wraparound sunglasses. And on the other bed, beautiful, man-shaped curves lying all across the bed was his 335 red guitar. And I, you know, John Lee said, pull up a chair. Pulled up the chair, the room was all dark, and the TV was on. And John Lee's lying back, you know, lying on the bed, you know, watching TV. He's got his wraparound sunglasses. And this is the man that sang, I'm mad, I'm bad, I'm gonna cut you, I'm like Jesse James, I'm gonna beat you, you be messing with my baby, I'm gonna kill you, I'm gonna tell you something that you ain't never done before, I'm gonna shoot you, I'm gonna break every bone in your body. Well, this guy was lying in bed watching TV, and I look over at the TV, and this guy is singing, I'm mad and I'm bad, was watching Lassie. No, I don't do it in the book, but John Lee, never on stage, but he had a terrible stutter, you know, when he was off stage. And he's watching Lassie, and I look over, and he can tell I'm, you know, realizing that he's watching Lassie, and he said, you know, Peter, that Lassie, he one mother smart dog. To John Lee.
I kind of feel like that should end it, don't you? Mr. Peter Wolf, I can't thank you enough for spending time with us tonight and
well,
for the body of work, for the entertainment, the lyrics, the music, all these years. Thank you.
Thank you. I really have to say, I really thank everybody for coming out. This is a dream come true for me. I don't want to get tearful here, but thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Writers on a New England Stage, a partnership between the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and NHPR. Our host for the evening was Rick Ganley. The Music Hall's executive director is Tina Sautel. NHPR's president and CEO is Jim Schachter. NHPR's producer for Writers on a New England Stage is Sarah Plord. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. NHPR's production manager is me, Dan Cahill. The Music Hall's production manager is Jonna Morris. Music Hall live sound and recording engineer is Ian Martin. Musical director and band is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. And the Music Hall literary producer is Brittany Wasson. If you missed any part of this show, go to nhpr.org/writers and download the Writers on a New England Stage podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. This is NHPR.